From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. First of all, you should know that if you believe in a conspiracy theory, that Barack Obama wasn't born in the U.S., for example, or that the attacks on 9/11 were planned and carried out by the U.S. government, you're not going to get an argument from Jonathan Kay. Kay has written a book about conspiracy theories and the people who believe them. It's not to say that there isn't evidence to debunk these ideas, but that's not what his book is about. Kay explores how these theories come about. He looks at their history, their evolution. In some ways, the book is about why we believe and why we don't. Jonathan Kay will join us today. All of this, he says, is a cause and a symptom of an intellectual and a civic crisis, why people don't know how or what to trust. We invite you to join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jonathan Kay's book is an examination of conspiracy theories and the people who spread them. It's not a book that rebuts these theories. It's a book that explains where they come from and why people believe them. Kay says that when you explore the fantasy universes that come with the stories, when you delve into the minds of those who tell the stories, you come to understand them. And Kay says that's the first step in defending the rationalist tradition. Today in the program, we're exploring the nature of conspiracy theories, the idea that President Obama wasn't born in the United States, for example, or that 9/11 was an inside job, the fears over fluoride and vaccines, that the Holocaust didn't happen, all of that. Jonathan Kay says this is a cause and a symptom of an intellectual and a civic crisis. His book is called Among the Truthers, A Journey Through America's Growing Conspiracist Underground. Jonathan Kay is a managing editor of Canada's National Post. He's also a columnist for the paper's op-ed page. Kay is co-author of the book The Volunteer, The Incredible True Story of an Israeli Spy on the Trail of International Terrorists, and is joining us today from a studio in Toronto. And Jonathan Kay, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to I want to start with this idea of skepticism and something you say in the book. You write that one thing that comes up in the book is that your sense that just sheer skepticism when you're dealing with these kinds of outlandish theories kind of isn't enough to confront and deal with conspiracy theories. You call it a two-edged sword. So I wanted to get a sense of what you mean by that, because in some ways you're saying that it's that you have to apply faith in some ways almost to all of this, or trust anyway. Talk about that.
Yeah. Distrust is the universal element in all conspiracy theories. The idea that the world we live in is not the world that authority figures present it as, that there is some unseen evil force that lurks beyond our elected government officials. And I think a little bit of distrust is a healthy thing.
Sure.
I would hate to live in a society where everyone took completely on faith everything our government said, because sometimes people in government do lie. And I think it's very important to acknowledge that. What happens with conspiracy theorists, however, is that they take that healthy spirit of skepticism and that becomes a creed unto itself. And they don't trust anything. They don't trust organized religion. They don't trust their government. In some cases, they don't trust mainstream civic associations. And skepticism becomes their guiding creed, to the point that they become nihilistic in the sense that you can never have an argument with them, because any authority you cite, they will simply say, well, that's not true. That's part of the ruling establishment. That's state propaganda. And as I say, it's a form of nihilism where they extrapolate the very legitimate questions that people do have about authority, and they extrapolate that into wild narratives about government officials blowing up skyscrapers.
You know, a lot of the book is about, and we'll get to this, of course, as we go along, the particulars of why we believe, how we come to try to find patterns in the universe and in the story of our lives, those kinds of things. But the book is also about particular stories. I mean, it's not just a dispassionate sort of academic argument. You meet these people, you talk to these people, as the subtitle implies, you go on this journey through all of this. And I wanted to get a sense of how you sort of struck on that idea. I guess what you figured, I've got to go out there and I've got to meet them if I'm going to understand them properly. I can't just read an academic paper to help give me a sense of all of that.
That's a very good question. like many journalists, perhaps yourself included, I get lots of email from conspiracy theorists. And like most journalists, I used to just hit the delete button on it because I'd get just so many, and I just thought, well, this is just part of the annoyance that goes along with journalism. But after a while, I became intrigued. Why do people believe these things? Why do people believe that George Bush blew up the World Trade Center? Why do people believe that fluoride is bad for them? Why do people believe that vaccines cause autism, even though that has been debunked? And when I looked at the literature about conspiracy theories, there was basically two kinds of literature. There was literature produced by the conspiracy theorists themselves, which is the internet is full of it. And then there was a few books that were out there basically written by people making fun of conspiracy theorists. And, you know, you can buy those at the bookstore too.
Yeah.
There were very few, in fact, no books that I could find that involved people sitting down with conspiracy theorists and trying to figure out why they believe what they do. That is the book that I wanted to write. And I should say that when I sat down with conspiracy theorists, my first question wasn't, what do you believe? Because sometimes you'll get a four-hour answer.
Right.
And the details of that, I mean, if you want to find out what 9/11 truthers believe, there's 100 websites you can go to on the web. The first question I always asked them was, when did you start believing this? Because I wanted to know what was going on in their life, what was going on in their mind when they became so incredibly distrustful of the U.S. government that they thought it was going to willfully murder 3,000 of its own citizens.
So that turning point, what did you find? That was the moment when they said, when they find a kind of a realization, I can't trust the established order like I thought I could.
Yes. And originally, when I began the book project, I thought that I was going to find some universal key to why these people believed what they do. What I found instead was that the people I was interviewing clustered into different groups. And after conducting hundreds of interviews, I found that these clusters were recognizable. And the clusters corresponded to the psychological reasons that people were drawn to conspiracy theories. And in Chapter 5 of my book, Among the Truthers, I take people into those 8 different clusters. For instance, some of the conspiracy theorists I interviewed were young college-age conspiracy theorists, and I call them the firebrands. These are the people who go marching around campuses with signs. And for them, conspiracy theories, it's much like Marxism used to be for another generation of students, or what anarchism once was. It's a fighting creed. It's something to shock people. It's something revolutionary. It's a bold new ideology that upsets the established order. And for them, it's basically, it fulfills that need for a revolutionary creed like that at that point in their life. Mm. But as I say, there's about 8 different categories, and they all have different psychological needs.
I actually want to break down some of those. The failed historian is one, which we'll come to, which is kind of fascinating in that it's sort of about Sigmund Freud. It's a really interesting concept. But let me say this first, because I want to get to this point, which is important for the book. Whenever there's tumult and there's war and there's conflict, this kind of thinking seems to kind of rear its head. So there is people who say, look, this is just a phase. The argument in the book is that, you know, for you, though, this isn't a temporary phenomenon. There's more to it than that. It's far-reaching. It has these implications. And you're really concerned about it. And I wanted you to talk about that.
It does have far-reaching implications. You know, I mean, a lot of this has to do with the effect of the internet, which we can talk about later. But, you know, if you look at the problems the United States has now, things like health care and debt reduction, conspiracy theories have made it much more difficult for the United States to address these serious problems. How do you have a conversation about health care with someone who believes that Barack Obama's health initiative was a plan to create death panels to kill grandma? How do you talk about national security with someone who thinks that the 9/11 terrorist attacks were an inside job? How do you talk about politics in general with someone who thinks that Barack Obama is an illegal alien who's trying to impose Sharia on the United States? How do you talk about debt reduction with someone who thinks that Obama's policies are part of a communist plot to destroy capitalism, which I was surprised to see was a remarkably common theme in my interviews with Tea Party radicals. So we're not just talking about conspiracy theories as sort of, you know, an X-Files diversion.
Yeah.
This is a very real threat to the marketplace of ideas in the United States, and it's making it more difficult to address real problems that the country is facing.
In the past, you say that the rifts that we would have, social, you know, disagreements and political disagreements, we healed these by our intellectual establishments, our political establishments. But that doesn't work anymore. That's part of the reason why this trend in conspiracy theories is on the rise, I suppose.
Yes. It used to be that, I mean, there were always going to be dissidents and oddballs and paranoiacs in society. But usually you could count on things like the mainstream media and mainstream religion and government to create this consensus and bring people back into a mainstream fold.
Yeah.
And that's broken down. Religion is one of the reasons. You know, organized religion is now held in disrepute in many circles. The scandals affecting the Vatican have been a big part of that. But just generally, people are a lot less religious than they used to be. But also the mainstream media, which used to have a powerful centralizing effect on opinion, bringing people into a mainstream consensus about reality, that doesn't have the monopoly on public opinion it once did, which in some senses is a good thing, but in some senses is a very, very bad thing, because almost all of the conspiracy theorists that I interviewed for my book, none of them got their news from the mainstream media because they all believe that people like you and me are completely corrupt and we're on the take from the U.S. government. Mm. Instead, they get their news from the internet, and not just the internet generally, but a few hand-picked websites where they find paranoid opinions directly in line with their own paranoid opinions. So they basically are inhabiting echo chambers. And these echo chambers are populated by people just like them, you know, whether they're blogs or websites or whatever. And so once they've gone down the rabbit hole, they're very, very, it's very difficult to bring them back out because they're not exposing themselves to mainstream opinions anymore. And this is something that wasn't possible 20 or 30 years ago.
Mm.
20 or 30 years ago, if you were a JFK conspiracy theorist or whatnot, you had to a certain extent, you had to interact with the mainstream media because that was the only way you were going to get news. Now it's possible to get all of your information from handpicked internet sources, which simply echo your own paranoias. And that part is new.
There's a point you made earlier, and I wanted to sort of underline. There's an email we got from a listener, Steve, who writes, "We need a better phrase than conspiracy theory to describe the phenomenon you're discussing. The plain reality," Steve writes, "is that conspiracies do happen. They happen all the time because humans are social creatures who plan and work together to accomplish mutual ends. We conspire incessantly," he says, "for good ends and for ill." And I guess we should make that point, Jonathan Kay. It's important to say, as you do in the book, that some conspiracies are very real. And sometimes we just don't know the truth of it all.
That's a very good comment that you got in by email. And I should say that that point is addressed straight up in the introduction to my book. And I acknowledge that it's true. Some conspiracies are very real. Watergate, for instance, Iran-Contra, the actual Al-Qaeda conspiracy to attack the World Trade Center. When I talk about conspiracy theories in my book, I'm talking about them in a very specific way, and I describe this at greater length in the introduction to my book. What I'm talking about is a way of thinking that protects the conspiracy theorist from any new evidence that is in contradiction to their theory because they simply expand the purported conspiracy.
Yeah.
So, for instance, if I'm talking to a 9/11 conspiracy theorist and I cite the 9/11 Commission report, they'll say, oh, the 9/11 Commission, they're in on the conspiracy. And then I'll mention the media, and oh, the media's in on the conspiracy. The judiciary is in on the conspiracy. Obama and Bush were both in on the conspiracy. So when I talk about conspiracy theorists, it's a particular way of thinking that simply expands the purported conspiracy to swallow any new contrary fact. This is a way of thinking that's particular to conspiracy theorists. And this is how I define the term conspiracy theory in my book. It's someone who thinks in this way, someone who responds to contrary evidence in this way.
And you write about how generally there are two kinds of conspiracy theories, those that are driven by the event or those that are systemic. And we should say that you're focused on the latter, the systemic nature of conspiracy theories.
Yeah. Systemic conspiracy theories are theories that purport to explain all of world events.
Right.
The example I give in the book is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is a notorious anti-Semitic hoax from the early part of the 20th century. And one of the reasons the protocols were so popular among anti-Semites was that it purported to explain all the bad things that happened in the world, wars, depressions, plagues, everything, and laid those things at the feet of the Jews. And it purported to explain that the Jews were basically in charge of all the banks and governments, and it was a systemic theory of how the world was run. And New World Order conspiracy theories in our age are like that. Bilderberger conspiracy theories are like that. However, as you say, there's other smaller conspiracy theories about individual events. For instance, someone may be a Princess Di conspiracy theorist and be obsessed with the idea that Princess Diana isn't really dead or that the Mossad killed Princess Diana. And they may be obsessed with that particular conspiracy theory and not particularly care who runs the world government. In my book, I'm more focused on people who have conspiracy theories about the way the whole world is run because, A, those people are more common, and, B, those views tend to be more toxic.
So I know it's difficult to generalize, and you get really particular in the book, but do you have a sense of what it is that they want? Is it about revealing the truth, that there is an absolute truth out there, and they're trying to get at it? Because you say in the book that in some ways this search, this obsessive search for many to find more and more details about this theory that they believe gives them some kind of, you say, stability almost, I guess, and purpose, really.
Yes. In many cases, especially on the internet, the people who are real evangelists for conspiracy theories, they see themselves as prophet figures, that they are preaching this truth about how the world really is and how they have to make the rest of us understand their truth. And it gives meaning to their lives because they feel like important historical figures because they feel that history is going to vindicate them. They're mocked and ridiculed now, but one day history will reveal them to be true heroes. But another factor is that for many of these people, conspiracy theories are a replacement for religion. Conspiracy theories do not supply a god, but they do supply a devil. And for many people, a devil figure is more important than a god figure because a devil figure can help explain the age-old question of why bad things happen to good people. And if you look at a lot of these conspiracy theories, it basically is an explanation for why bad, evil things happen in the world. And it's very uncomfortable to think that bad, evil things happen for random reasons. In a way, it's much more comforting to the human mind to imagine that wars and depressions and all these horrible things happen because there is some unseen force lurking behind the shadows, and that if we simply unmask that evildoer, then we can set the world right. That's a very comforting idea because it turns human existence into a sort of quest, a quest to rid the world of evil, as opposed to the much more difficult realization that sometimes bad things just happen and there's nothing we can do about it.
Jonathan Kay is with us. His book is Among the Truthers, A Journey Through America's Growing Conspiracist Underground. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the nature of conspiracy theories and conspiracy theorists. Our guest is the journalist Jonathan Kay. He's written a book. It's called Among the Truthers, A Journey Through America's Growing Conspiracist Underground. So I want to talk about the history you write about of the way we believe and how this kind of thinking evolves. I mean, you write about this development psychologist at the University of Michigan who in the late 1990s, you say, was trying to understand why so many Americans had these doubts about evolution. Her name was Margaret Evans, and she found some interesting things when she conducted this study where she involved children of various ages. And she asked them, I guess the essential question, Jonathan Kay, was where do animals come from?
Yes, and, the boring answer is, oh, they evolve from originally unicellular life forms. but that's not an answer that appeals to human psychology.
Yeah.
Children like to believe that lions exist so we could put them in zoos, or that dogs exist so that they could wag their tails and we can pet them. Basically, the idea that things in life exist for a purpose, and that when things happen or creatures appear, it is not just because of the random effects of evolution or chance, that there is some intention or purpose behind it. Mm. And this is the same attitude which carries itself over toward our reaction to disasters, that it isn't just that tectonic plates shift and an earthquake happens and people die. It's that someone or something set that in motion. There is some intention behind the evil. And I talk about this obviously in the context of conspiracy theories, but it's also one of the things behind the creation of religion.
Yeah.
For which conspiracy theories are, in some cases, a replacement.
The editor of Skeptic Magazine, Michael Shermer, calls this this idea of the world having, you know, being controlled by someone as agenticity? Is that the way to put it?
I think that's how you pronounce it, yeah. Yes.
You say this idea informs many of our modern beliefs about government. And what's the idea, the concept that, look, someone is in control, right?
Yeah, that, again, bad things don't just happen by accident. That there always is some hidden hand behind things that are bad. And by the way, you saw this in the reaction, for instance, to the Japan earthquake. Mm. You know, you would think that an earthquake is exactly the kind of disaster that we couldn't blame on any human. You know, just the physical force required to move tectonic plates is beyond the realm of human engineering. And yet you find plenty of conspiracy theorists who claim that the Japan earthquake and also the Haiti earthquake were the results of U.S. Machinations, and in particular something called HARP, H-A-A-R-P, which is the name of a giant radiological research project up in Alaska, which is a subject of obsession among conspiracy theorists. And they're convinced that by manipulating HARP in a particular way, that the U.S. government can cause volcanoes to erupt or tectonic plates to shift. And somehow they get to the idea that no matter what the natural disaster is, you can find a villain or a demon to blame it on. Mm. And as I said earlier in the show, this is a very precious idea that bad things don't just happen. They happen because evil people make them happen. And then if we could just unmask who these evil people are, the world would be a better place.
You also write about the way our bodies or this kind of thinking has evolved, which you say is the same way our bodies have evolved over time. Essentially, we've become programmed to believe, our biology tells us, to look at phenomena as being real. Talk about that, because that's really interesting.
Yeah, and I and this isn't something that I was smart enough to think about myself. Michael Shermer and others have spoken about this. The example given is someone, going back thousands of years, one of our primitive ancestors, often the savanna of Africa, he's off hunting for food, and he hears a rustling in the grass, and the rustling could just be the wind, or the rustling could be a poisonous snake. Now, if the rustling is a poisonous snake, but this guy thinks it's the wind and ignores it, he's dead. On the other hand, if he thinks it's a poisonous snake, but it's actually the wind, he gets scared, but nothing happens. The idea behind this is that natural selection programs us to think that bad things are afoot and that there are predators who are engineering those bad things, because the people who don't believe those things tend to die. The people who are paranoid and embrace this agenticity that we talked about before, those are the people who have a heightened chance of survival. So as a species, we are programmed to look around us, to look for patterns, to look for evil schemes, to look for other tribes plotting against us. Mm. This often manifests itself in very antisocial, pathological, warlike behavior in modern humans. But back in the Stone Age, it was actually a very useful instinct to have.
Well, you talk about how these theories were fairly simple early on in human history, you know, folk tales for peasants. Mostly it was pretty local kind of stuff. But then you say that conspiracy theories started to take on another shape, get another dimension, get bigger even, as capitalism and industrialism started to take hold. And this is when they started to, I don't know if spin out of control, but certainly get pretty big.
Yeah, and this is, I'm glad you asked, it's one of the themes of my book, is that when society was fairly simple, when society existed primarily at the village level, and even, you know, the Middle Ages, most people didn't ever leave their villages back in the Middle Ages. They're small farming communities. This is the world that most people knew. Conspiracy theories back in those days tended to be very small scale, you know, along the lines of there were a bunch of Jews and they poisoned the well, and so let's go kill some Jews. That was a typical conspiracy theory in the Middle Ages. What happened as a result of the Industrial Revolution is that society got a lot more complicated, and in particular the French Revolution, because the French Revolution taught the Western world that a small group of people could take over a major country if they had a revolutionary ideology, and it scared people. In fact, many modern conspiracy theories originated in the years immediately after the French Revolution. And then the Industrial Revolution came and the onset of consumer capitalism, and society got very, very complicated. And all sorts of new technologies came on the scene. Public health technologies like things like vaccinations and water fluoridation and broadcast media. And people became very scared by the rapid change, and they needed theories that made sense of these sort of things. As a result, conspiracy theories themselves became much more complex. And instead of just being folktales about some group of Jews or whatnot poisoning a well, they became elaborate folktales about a large group of Jews taking over all of society. I mention Jews because anti-Semitism and conspiracism are very closely linked in the history of conspiracy theories.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I was just going to say you have Jews and Freemasons who figure into conspiracy theories for, you know, decades and decades, centuries and centuries. Still do, of course. But then you write about how this new villain shows up in the early 19th century. And this is the Order of the Illuminati, which was a real group. In fact, a real cult, you say. But this gave it another spin, I guess.
Yeah, well, the Illuminati, it's very interesting because to this day, after writing this book, Among the Truthers, I still get email from people claiming that I'm a tool of the Illuminati or that the Illuminati were behind 9/11. And in a way, it's very, it's almost quaint because the Illuminati haven't existed for more than two centuries. The Illuminati, as you say, were a very real group. They existed in Bavaria in the late 18th century, and they were a genuinely creepy group. They had secret rituals, and you couldn't reveal your identity. And the guy who led them, I believe he was a law professor, was a somewhat sinister figure. And they truly did want to upset the established order of things, which is why the local powers that be basically destroyed the group after only about 10 years of existence. So the Illuminati haven't existed for 200 years. Despite that, they have become these figures of legend in conspiracist circles. And that includes in the United States, which is weird because there is no known record of any Illuminati ever coming to the United States. Despite that, you will find plenty of websites that claim the Illuminati control Washington. But they fed into this conspiracist narrative, the conspiracist narrative that emerged after the French Revolution and became extremely prominent later on in the 20th century, was that all of the disruptive forces affecting our society, capitalism, industrialization, secularization, all this was being caused by a small group of ideologues or religious radicals. You could call them the Illuminati or the Masons or the Jews. But the structure of the conspiracy theory was always the same, that these people wanted to destroy the natural order of things. And for a lot of people, the natural order of things was farming. And you had the rapid urbanization of society, and that scared a lot of people. And as we discussed, rapid technological advances, which also scared a lot of people. Anytime there's rapid change, people get scared and conspiracy theories flourish.
So you've got conspiracism, which is sort of putting down roots in Europe, on the far right, far left as well, of course. Let's talk about how it evolves in America, because you say it follows a different pattern in some ways from Europe. You talk about the different influences, and I kind of wanted to go through some of them. Apocalyptic millenarianism. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
is one of them. Explain that. Work us through that, if you would.
Well, as we've been discussing, conspiracy theories in Europe in the 19th and 20th century, often they were very anti-Semitic, but basically they dealt with the theme of a small group of individuals trying to upset the natural, aristocratic, monarchist, pastoral order of things and trying to create new isms, like capitalism and liberalism and Nietzscheism. It's even something that's discussed in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. In the United States, some of those influences were there, but there were other influences. And one of the main influences is evangelical Christianity, which, of course, was much more popular in the United States than in Europe. And the reason evangelical Christianity was such a prominent influence on conspiracism is because of the theme contained in the last book of the New Testament, Book of Revelation, and the idea of a coming epic cosmic battle between the forces of good and the forces of evil. And this idea very powerfully reflects one of the ideas of conspiracism, which is that there is some evil satanic cabal which is conspiring to destroy society, and that good patriotic people have to rise up and address this challenge. I mean, this is a religious idea contained in the Book of Revelation, but it has its secular counterpart in many ostensibly secular conspiracy theories. You know, New World Order conspiracy theories typically are secular, but they very much borrow from this evangelical tradition that there is this cosmic struggle going on between this Antichrist, which you could call it the Bilderbergers or the New World Order or the neocons or whatever secular variant of the conspiracy theory you choose, but it's basically the same structure as this religious idea that there's this cosmic battle that is about to be unleashed and that we all have to pick sides in it.
So antichrists, false prophets, the elders of Zion, Satan, secular humanism, they're all sort of that demonic figure, I guess.
Well, it all comes down to this Manichean struggle between good and evil. And I should say that birther conspiracy theories often feed into this. If you look at the idea that Barack Obama was born outside the United States, that sounds like a fairly limited conspiracy theory. But if you sit down and interview a lot of these people, you find it often goes much deeper. They don't just think, oh, he's constitutionally ineligible to be president of the United States because he happened to be born in Kenya or Indonesia. Very often, the people who believe these things will wrap it into much more ambitious conspiracy theories, in particular the idea that he is some kind of false prophet and that his role in the United States is to usher in some kind of evil force, whether it's communism or, as they see it, radical Islam. It's never just that he is constitutionally ineligible to be president. There's always some larger agenda that's put forward, and it feeds into this idea of him being a false prophet and in league with some kind of demonic force.
You say that if conspiracism is a collective ailment, then the United States has always had it. In fact, infected at birth is how you put it. And I guess the question is why? Because our defiance, our resentment of authority is kind of the essence of who we are and the story of our founding?
Well, yeah. You know, in a way, it originates in a very heroic and healthy struggle. The United States was founded in revolt against Great Britain and against a very real conspiracy of a foreign tyrant to oppress Americans and to keep America under Britain's thumb. And again, this is a healthy impulse to throw off foreign occupation. However, what happened is because that is such a hallowed idea in the American collective identity, you know, the idea of Paul Revere and the founding fathers, these are quasi-saints in the secular American historical tradition. Because their stories are so hallowed, it's become programmed into the American psyche that it is every patriot's duty to constantly be on the hunt for more foreign plots against the United States. So in the 20th century, you had, you had McCarthyism.
Sure.
You had all sorts of plots. People were worried that the Vatican was trying to take over the United States, and you had all kinds of conspiracy theories that every Catholic church was teeming with Roman soldiers who were going to come out and take over the United States, Masonic conspiracy theories. And a lot of this goes back, as I say, to this founding idea in the United States that you constantly had to be vigilant about foreign agents looking to take over the United States, because that it's part of the political DNA of the United States, and it persists to this day.
Let's go to the phones. Thad has been joining us in Salt Lake City. Thad, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Thank you very much. One of the things that interests me about conspiracy theories is often, you know, we hear about some small aspect of them, but if you think about them, they're actually pretty broad or vast. So, for instance, the Obama birther theory seems to have behind it this idea that in 1961, a group of evil people picked Obama to come here to become the socialist person who was going to put this on America, which suggests, A, a lot of people are behind this, and B, there are a lot of other sleeper people around enabling him and or potential other candidates for being the socialist person. How do these people think about these issues and discuss them?
Good question. Jonathan Kay.
That is a very good question, and it's true that if you look at these what appear to be very limited conspiracy theories, they often, you scratch the surface, and they're often much broader than that. In the case of Obama, you know, John Stewart, a year or two ago, he did a great riff on this, where he tried to imagine what people were thinking about in the 50s or 60s as they were hatching this plot. And the downside, of course, of the conspiracy was that they would have to wait 50 years before it would come to fruition, and they'd all be dead. There is no logical way that theory can be defended, except by me repeating what I said before, that these are essentially, in some cases, quasi-religious narratives, that These people are looking for a demon figure, in many cases, to blame America's 2008 financial crisis on. That was one of the things. I talk about 9/11 in my book, but a big part of it was the financial crisis. And especially on the right, you had people who were looking for some demon on which they could blame this apparent failure of capitalism. And because it's a quasi-religious narrative, and because Obama is depicted as a demon-type figure, their conspiracy can't really be analyzed in conventional, rational, intellectual ways, because it doesn't make sense. But to be honest, I didn't try and argue with these people, because arguing with a conspiracy theorist never works. You never convince them. Instead, I just tried to get inside their way of thinking, which, as I say, is somewhat religious in nature.
Thad, glad you called. It's interesting, you write about the JFK assassination, of course, and this idea of being able to pull off this grand feat, something like the would have had to have been involved in the, at least if it conforms to the conspiracy theory, the JFK assassination. But you say millions of Americans believed there was a conspiracy, and it wasn't, you say, a mob phenomenon. It came, as you say, to pervade the West's educated classes as well.
In the case of JFK, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, JFK is, I speak to a certain extent about JFK in my book, because I'm not an expert, but you can't talk about American conspiracism without talking about JFK.
Of course.
And the thing about JFK is, one, you had this incredible spirit of distrust that grew out of that. The distrust in the idea that government could protect us. If you can't protect the president, how could you protect the rest of us? So people became very distrustful. And also the idea that it is impossible that a powerful figure like a president could simply be killed by random chance.
Yeah.
And this is something that you see in reaction to the killing of any great figure, and not just presidents. The reaction to the Princess Di's death, the reaction, even figures like Kurt Cobain, there's all sorts of Kurt Cobain conspiracy theories out there.
Osama bin Laden, you're already seeing the theories about Osama bin Laden still being alive, or, I mean, this fits into that category as well, I guess.
There's a powerful psychological reflex in the human mind that said that a great historical figure, whether they're good or evil, can't simply be killed in the usual way, in the way that you or I would die, that they have to be killed in some sort of epic or tragic way. And it didn't compute for many Americans that one radical, Lee Harvey Oswald, could kill JFK. It simply didn't make sense. That was the beginning of the modern age of American conspiracism. And, of course, it took more force in the 60s and 70s when you saw very real conspiracies such as Watergate. And plus, Americans were skeptical of the Gulf of Tonkin. And then 9/11, it gained more force. Mm. But this started 5 decades ago.
Jonathan Kay, his book is called Among the Truthers, A Journey Through America's Growing Conspiracist Underground. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Jonathan Kay. We're talking about his book, Among the Truthers, A Journey Through America's Growing Conspiracist Underground. Let's go back to the phones. David has been waiting in Ogden, Utah. David, welcome.
Hi, Doug. I heard that you were going to introduce the show. When you introduced the show, you were going to say why and not go into bagging on, I don't mean yourself, I mean the author of the book, bagging on conspiracy theorists, because you would need to cite specific examples and get into specific things. Like, the Federal Reserve, for example.
Well, hold on, David. Hold on 1 second. Now,
yeah.
I hope we made it clear, as
yeah.
Jonathan Kay does in his book, that he's not about to rebut particular theories, that he is trying to explain why people think the way they do. I don't know. You say he's bagging on conspiracy theorists. Jonathan, how do you respond to that idea?
Well, I think your caller has a point in one sense, that to the extent that I'm trying to understand the psychology of conspiracy theorists and to the extent that I'm writing about them in that way, I'm presuming that what they say isn't true.
Right.
And there's no getting around that fact that my book is written from the perspective that the 9/11 truth movement, as it's called, is nonsense, that birthers are nonsense, that every other conspiracy theory I talk about is nonsense. And then I get to the intellectual project of trying to figure out why these people believe what they do. When I talk to conspiracy theorists who have read my book, they find the book patronizing. And I don't blame them for finding it patronizing because I'm assuming that they are wrong and I'm trying to explain why they're wrong. And they claim, well, you don't take our ideas seriously. It's true. I don't take seriously the idea that Bush and Cheney intentionally bombed the World Trade Center as a pretext for war in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's absolutely true. And there's no getting around that fact. And I guess your caller is right. If he wants to call it bagging on conspiracy theorists, I bag on them, but I'm quite proud of the fact that most reviewers who've read my book appreciate the fact that I'm not mocking them. In fact, the Wall Street Journal reviewer said that I write about conspiracy theorists in an affectionate way, which I take as a badge of pride because it means I was successful in not carrying a spirit of mockery in my book.
David, I'll give
that
you a final word.
That doesn't sound very affectionate. And I would say from the moment you're born, you're lied to. Parenting, in order to get a child to do what they want it to do, they have to lie to the child. Come with me, and they'll give an example that'll be a lie. Or so-and-so will get you, or, you know, so on and so forth. But I also want to say, when you get to a certain age, you're continually told you live in a democracy. No. We live in a republic. It's a representative. It's not a representative democracy because you're only voting for a representative. That there's a huge problems with much of the stuff we are told today. Why are we invading Iraq and Afghanistan? To spread freedom? No, it's to get oil.
David, I'm going to jump in there. I imagine you have a lot of those.
Reserve? Is the Federal Reserve a private organization or a government organization? The Federal Reserve.
David, I'm glad you called.
Organization.
Thanks very much. Okay. I think that would have gone on a long time. I'm guessing, Jonathan Kay, when you do these things, you get a lot of that. Is that right? I haven't hung up on many callers in my time.
Yeah. Look, it's yes, I had a lot of conversations like that. When I did the interviews for my book, one of the nice things was it was just me and a tape recorder and someone, and I could spend 4 hours listening to them.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, this is broadcast media, and we don't have the luxury of being able to listen to someone for 4 hours. But it's one of the problems of dealing with the subject that people who have conspiracy theories about 9/11 or the Federal Reserve, these theories are very complicated, and it takes hours and hours for them to spit them out. And it's difficult in a show of this format.
Yeah,
I've been on a lot of shows like this, and it's very difficult.
Yeah. David, we're glad you called nonetheless. So I do want to break down some of the different varieties of why people believe the way they do. Let's start with the midlife crisis case, which I think is pretty intriguing. This is, for you, one particular – these all fit in a typology, as you say. Where does midlife crisis fit?
Yeah, as you say in Chapter 5 of my book, I talk about these 8 different psychological clusters of conspiracy theorists, and I organize them according to what psychological need I think conspiracism plays in their life. In the case of the midlife crisis case, it's typically a man, most of these are men, in their late 40s or 50s or 60s, who is looking for some radical break in their life. Midlife crisis conspiracy theorists I spoke with were often people living very sort of mundane, workaday existences, and then the light bulb goes off, oh my God, reality is a fraud, and then they leave their wife, they leave their kids, and they're 24/7 conspiracy theorists, and that's their new life. And they abandon all their old friends, and their new social circle is composed entirely of people they meet on the internet. And the example I give in the book is Richard Gage, who some of your listeners might know of as the leader of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Yeah.
He was formerly an architect in California. And then, this light bulb just went off in 2006, abandoned his life as he knew it before, moved out of his house, his marriage ended. And he has spent the last 5 years basically being an evangelist, traveling the world, preaching the gospel of 9/11 Truth. And he's got a completely new life. He goes in front of crowds of hundreds of people. I know because I've seen him speak in Montreal and New York City, and he gets standing ovations, and instead of the girlfriend in the sports car, he's got this life as a conspiracy theorist, and he's become a sort of rock star.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned the firebrand. We've talked, I think, a bit about the evangelical doomsayer, although not much about that. But I want to get to the failed historian. You say the starting point for this one is Sigmund Freud, and not Sigmund Freud's theories, but Sigmund Freud's life.
Yeah, I talk a little bit about in the book about how he became a William Shakespeare conspiracy theorist because he needed the plot of Hamlet to dovetail with his theory of Oedipal love. And more broadly speaking, the failed historian is a conspiracy theorist who embraces conspiracy theories because he needs to change history in some radical way in order to explain his ideology. So, for instance, if you're an Afrocentric conspiracy theorist, you know, you have this emotionally and ideologically felt need to put blacks, or in particular African black cultural achievements, at the center of history. And when you read history books and you find out, well, maybe history didn't turn out like that, you embrace conspiracy theories as a way to explain that. Mm. Or Islamists often will become conspiracy theorists because they find it maddening that history hasn't turned out with Islam spreading around the globe and with Islam being the dominant civilization. So they embrace anti-Western and anti-Israeli conspiracy theories as a way to explain why their ideologically held expectations of the world haven't come to fruition. So for them, conspiracy theories is a way to reconcile their ideology and their hopes about the world with the reality of the world, which is often very disappointing.
Say something about the damaged survivor. Jenny McCarthy is a good example of this that you mentioned, which seems to play out in her theories about how vaccines gave her son, who's autistic, autism.
Yeah. Damaged survivors, these are conspiracy theorists who typically have had some medical trauma in their life, or they have a family member who's experienced medical trauma, and they become extremely cynical about conventional medicine, vaccines, chemotherapy, that sort of thing. And over time, they extrapolate this distrust in conventional medicine to distrust in corporate America more generally. And they develop conspiracy theories about the idea of how the pharmaceutical companies are trying to poison us, they're trying to profit from us by giving us diseases instead of curing our diseases. And the worst way this has manifested itself is in the case of autism, because some of these conspiracy theorists have convinced a lot of people that you shouldn't vaccinate your children because that will give them autism. This has been thoroughly debunked. There is no link between vaccines and autism. Your listeners should know that. But in the case of parents who have children who have autism, often the experience is so traumatic, and you know, this is understandable. It's a very difficult situation for a parent.
Sure.
They come to embrace conspiracy theories about big pharma because, as I write in my book, anger is a much more psychologically manageable emotion than disappointment. And if you have a villain you can blame for troubles in your life, it actually makes it psychologically easier to get through life than if you simply have to resign yourself to the idea, well, sometimes bad things happen for no reason.
I want to get to, as you do in the book, a whole chapter dealing with how you confront conspiracism. But let me get two quick questions in here that come via email. Dennis wonders, from Farmington, Utah, does belief in conspiracy stop people from participating in the civic process, like voting, for example?
Yes, absolutely. Because, well, take Alex Jones, for instance, who's a prominent conspiracy theorist and a radio host out in Texas. He's got a syndicated show. I interviewed him, and he said there's no real difference between Obama and Bush because both of them answer to the same corporate masters. Many of these conspiracy theorists believe there's no point in voting in elections because the people you're voting for are all controlled by the same overlord. You know, whether, as I say, whether it's the military-industrial complex or the Bilderbergers or the New World Order, it doesn't matter. The point is that they think of electoral politics as a sort of sham, and that's not good for the electoral system.
Here's one from Ken, who writes from Salt Lake City, which I think is a pretty good point. He says, Watergate was a theory that was validated by fact. So what's the prospect for discovering new, real conspiracies if there are so many fake ones running around? Are we going to be sort of deluded by all of that, all the silliness when something true actually comes around?
Well, as I say in the book, there's plenty of real conspiracies, but they are typically separated from the fake conspiracies by a simple fact that, you know, real conspiracies tend to be limited and grubby and incompetently conducted. That describes Watergate, and it describes most conspiracies. Generally, humans are very bad at perpetrating conspiracies because they're very bad at keeping secrets.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Whereas the conspiracies that you see, the type of conspiracies I read about in my book, tend to be out of Hollywood, where everyone is an evil genius, and these things go off without a hitch, and there's hundreds of people involved, but no one ever finds out because they're brilliant at covering their tracks. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing doesn't happen in real life.
Let me ask you this finally. Again, you try to how we can confront conspiracism. And you talk about, you say, don't argue, engaging with them is kind of a waste of time. But you say that we can protect our brains, you say, from conspiracy theories before we do get infected. I guess you're talking about young people in particular. There's a way to educate ourselves, right?
Yes. It's just the first thing you said. Once a person becomes a conspiracy theorist, it's very difficult to argue with them because whatever evidence you suggest, they'll just say, oh, that's been debunked, or they're just part of the conspiracy. As we talked about earlier, they'll just expand the conspiracy to swallow whatever new evidence you're giving them. The best way is prevention, to prevent people from going down the rabbit hole before they go down it. And I suggest in my book that conspiracism, this pattern of thought where you're tracing everything to some conspiracy of a small group of evildoers trying to control the world, that should be like racism or sexism or all the other isms. It's a toxic point of infection in our marketplace of ideas.
Jonathan Kay, his book, Among the Truthers, A Journey Through America's Growing Conspiracist Underground. Jonathan, thanks very much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.